From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, where no TV show has gone before, virtual reality level 5. We meet John Sacret Young, the producer of Fox TV's high-tech new show, VR5. He also created and produced the hit series, China Beach. Also, can-do capitalism in the age of crack. Journalist William Adler tells us about four enterprising brothers who built an empire on crack cocaine. At one point, the Chambers Brothers organization was one of the most successful businesses in Detroit during the 1980s. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Joan Osborne's debut album, Relish. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Oklahoma City officials report the death toll is now 142 from the bombing of the federal building. Fire and rescue crews added another victim to the list this morning. About 25 or 30 searchers resumed work today. Cranes were lifting out larger pieces of debris. Crews rested all night. Officials said yesterday the search will be confined to daylight hours only now. Assistant Fire Chief John Hansen says the building is too shaky to risk working through the night anymore. Engineers with laser scopes are poised to sound warning horns if the building starts to shift. House Speaker Newt Gingrich has decided to end his daily news briefings, which had been televised live on C-SPAN. Gingrich aides are blaming grandstanding by reporters. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Before Newt Gingrich, the daily speakers' conference was held prior to each session of the House, and cameras and microphones were generally barred. Gingrich opened up the process, allowing cameras and microphones in, and C-SPAN often broadcast the news conference live. But Gingrich held fewer and fewer speakers' conferences as the first 100 days came to a close, and now his office says it's ending the practice entirely. A spokesman blamed the press, saying some of the questioning by reporters had gotten flamboyant and in the way of a serious discussion of the news. Reporters who covered the conferences suggested the problem was Gingrich's inability to curb his tongue and his tendency to be too quick to comment on too many issues. Gingrich's office says the speaker will remain accessible to the press and will hold occasional news conferences and one-on-one interviews with reporters. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Japanese Prime Minister Tomiichi Murayama has started a 5-day visit to China. He remembered Japan's entry into World War II. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The Marco Polo Bridge incident is considered by many to be the date of China's formal entry into World War II. What followed was a brutal and bloody occupation of China by Japan's Imperial Army that would last until 1945. Today, in a gesture of reconciliation, Mr. Murayama became the first Japanese prime minister to visit the site on the outskirts of Beijing and called the 50th anniversary of the war's end a new starting point in Sino-Japanese relations. The Chinese have long sought a formal apology from Japan. Murayama himself has been a champion of his country's duty to own up to its past aggression, but a reluctant parliament says that would desecrate the memory of Japan's war dead. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
International mediators are inviting leaders of rebel Croatian Serbs and the Croatian government to urgent talks in Geneva. The representative of the European Union told reporters today the initiative was taken since the Croatian conflict seems to be spreading. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average eased up 42 points at 4,371. This is NPR. The government says its chief gauge of future economic activity has posted its biggest fall in 2 years. The March index of leading economic indicators dropped 0.5%. 6 of the 11 components that make it up were down. This is the latest evidence suggesting the nation's economy is slowing from the frenetic pace it set last year. It's also the sharpest drop in a year. The index of leading economic indicators is intended to predict economic activity 6 to 9 months in advance. A broad investigation into police brutality and corruption in New York has led to the indictment of 16 police officers. They've been arrested on several charges, including assault and insurance fraud. NPR's Melissa Block reports from New York.
The police officers are all from the 48th Precinct in the Bronx. They're charged with a variety of offenses, including beating up suspects and shaking down drug dealers. Among those arrested were three sergeants. Seven other officers are expected to be suspended for ignoring the corruption and may be dismissed from the force. This is the second major New York City police corruption scandal in just over a year. Last year, an investigation into what's become known as the Dirty 30, the 30th Precinct in Harlem, led to the arrests of more than 30 police officers. This latest scandal hits a precinct where the resident population is almost entirely Black and Hispanic. It also ranks among the 12 New York City precincts with the highest number of civilian complaints about police abuse and brutality. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
Connecticut police now say most of the military hardware they discovered in the back of a truck is harmless. Officers stopped the truck in New Britain, Connecticut last night for a noisy muffler. They arrested two men in the truck and said they found live military ordnance, including mortars and rocket-propelled grenades. Now the state police bomb squad says most of the stuff is inert training equipment. One man called local television stations saying he was an antiques dealer, but he was arrested anyway. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The newest new frontier on television this season is alternate realities. The X-Files explores extraterrestrial phenomena. The series Sliders takes viewers on a weekly excursion into a parallel universe. And then there's VR5. VR5 is a one-hour adventure series on Fox. Its title refers to Virtual Reality Level 5, which is a high-tech window into the subconscious. My guest is VR5's creator and executive producer, John Sacret Young. He says virtual reality technology is progressing so fast, it's hard to keep the show up to date. John Sacret Young is a new convert to the high-tech special effects that VR5 features. He's best known as the creator and producer of the hit series China Beach, a weekly drama set during the Vietnam War. He's also written the screenplays for the films Testament and Romero. The producers of VR5 conceive of 10 levels of virtual reality. I asked John Sacret Young to describe Level 5.
Well, I think probably in what we can do now, we are somewhere about what we would call VR3, and Virtual Reality 5 is a couple of steps beyond that. And what our character, Sydney Bloom, has discovered that she can do is she, using her computer, can take another person and their subconscious to a landscape that she programs and take herself. And there the two subconscious is meet. And so she can find out things that people aren't necessarily wearing on their sleeve but are carrying inside themselves. But she cannot control what she sees or what happens in there. And in a way, we've often talked about how it's a little bit like connecting perhaps your waking dream and your sleeping dream, that she can see in there symbols and she can see behavior, but sometimes things come colliding in that she did not anticipate. And they can be funny and they can be outrageous or they can be at times terrorizing.
Were you at all daunted in the beginning by the challenge of creating visuals for something that's before its time?
I think the challenge for me and for us was much about a number of things. One was, is there a way to create a different kind of television show? And how then do you make it look different? And who would be an interesting character to put into that landscape, if you will? And I think there are many shows on television, and television is now based in what I call a kind of rigidly franchised universe where you exist in a sea of cops, lawyers, and doctors. And we wanted to find a way to do something a little different and a little unique. And the concept of doing things in virtual reality seemed to us to be provocative. Provocative because I think it is an oncoming technology and an oncoming almost source of information, escape, and adventure. But also a way as a storyteller to maybe say, hey, I can play the scene in reality and I can play almost the same scene or a similar scene in virtual reality and it will be different. And it's a way, I suppose, to correct the first scene or a way to do it differently or a way to have a different point of view about that similar or same scene. And as a dramatist, that's a very provocative and very interesting.
The character, Sidney Bloom, is played by the actress Laurie Singer, and she's really a haunted and twisted character. Her father and her twin sister died in a car crash that Sidney survived. The mother is catatonic after this. I'd like to play a clip. And here Sidney is in VR5. She's in a mock courtroom setting, and she's questioning her father about his past.
Why did you lie to your family? Why did you kiss them goodbye and tell them you were going to the university? And then come home and have supper and play with them and then kiss them goodnight? And the whole time, there was a big part of you were leaving out, weren't you?
Objection! Counsel is leading the witness.
Overruled.
Which part?
The committee.
Objection! This is irrelevant, Your Honor.
Overruled.
Yes. I was a member.
Why did you lie to your family?
I was trying to protect you.
You were protecting yourself. What did you do to me? How come I'm the only one who can go into VR5? I don't know who I am. I don't know what I am. I'm afraid of myself.
The virtual reality allows this character to keep exploring and revisiting her past. Is this what initially intrigued you about the show, more than the high-tech visuals?
Well, I think one of the things that interested us was we have all this concern about, let's call it the millennium coming, whether it's the year 2000 or whether it's the information superhighway. And the truth seems to be that as the future comes at us, it also, sometimes mysteriously, but inevitably connects to the past. And what Sidney is discovering is she thinks that she is homebrewed a way to kind of, by accident, fall into her unique ability to do what she does, is to take people into VR5. What she doesn't realize yet is that it connects to her memory and that her kind of obsession with this is really also an unveiling of how the facts of her personal life, the facts of her memory, the facts of her history are indeed in some ways fiction. And it's almost like as she takes other people's in and other people into VR5 and takes herself in, it's like peeling an onion. And as the layers of the onion peel away, she discovers that what she thought to be true is in fact false. And she has to rediscover what actually happened to her.
How much do you have to go through to achieve the VR effects? And by that, I mean how much is done in post-production? How many layers of technical effects are there?
If you just take the main title of our show, there is sometimes 5, 6, 7 layers of picture kind of one on top of the other, dissolving in or dissolving out. And within that, there may be visual effects within each of those layers. So it becomes more and more complicated. And I think more and more daring and trying to push what you can do and discovering that it can be pushed. We use a process this year called CST where you take color film and you go back to black and white and then you recolor it, which leads to sometimes outrageous choices or moody choices. And that takes time. It takes them 15 business days to accomplish that task. And on a television schedule, that can be a little bit like you feel as if the film is going wet right on the air. You run out of time. That's as much time as you can take. But it is very much a post-production process. It becomes more and more important.
The main character, Sidney, uses a modem called an acoustic coupler. It has a phone receiver on it. It's part of her technique. And this modem, I'm told, is really antiquated. It hasn't been used in years. And I only know this because there are plenty of hackers out there picking apart each episode on the internet and on the computer bulletin boards, and they ridicule each mistake or perceived mistake in technology or in technical lingo. How concerned are you with keeping the show absolutely technically state of the art?
Well, I think we chose that for two reasons. One is it was visually simple and clear as to what was happening, and we felt that would help make her entering this world of VR5 accessible to an audience. And number two, we are, this is fiction, so there is a certain amount of license. But in addition, as I hear the stories of what's going on the internet, we've kept very quiet because everyone thinks it's about technology. when in fact her ability to do this is going to be revealed to be not so much about technology as probably about genetics. And it comes from her family and her father programming her. And she doesn't know that yet. And so it isn't about computer expertise as much as it is about probably what's going on in her own and her father's cerebellum. It's about ultimately the mind as a computer as opposed to, you know, her screen that is right in front of her.
So they're on the wrong track, in other words.
Right, right.
Are you a computer hacker yourself?
Absolutely was not. I was a guy who wrote with a pen or a pencil on scuzzy, sleazy yellow paper for as long as I could. And I've only worked on a laptop for, I think it's still less than 2 years. Though I could always type, I enjoyed and felt like a kinship, I suppose, to those who used to work with their hands, and that if I didn't have a writer's bump on the knuckle of my middle finger, I felt like something was wrong in my life. So this show has helped pull me kind of mewling and screaming into the late 20th century.
There are such a thing as VR boutiques, I understand, in Boston and in L.A. Have you been to any?
Oh, yes. We went down to San Diego, and there's some in the San Fernando Valley, and there's one in Pasadena, whether it's called Virtual World or there's a number of these things popping up, and they are interesting and exciting and intriguing, but they are not, of course, to the level of where we're going. And will we get to that level or how soon? I don't think anybody has the answer. But one of the fascinating things is that Lori Singer and I went down to Princeton University, where we met with two professors, one who showed us kind of what I would call an art walk, where you can now kind of go, let's say, to the Sistine Chapel, and you can, rather than just being on the ground staring up, you can, you know, it's almost like you are back there and you are on your back and you too are painting it. And you can get into that perspective. You can feel as if you're in three-dimensional space, getting that close and actually see the brush strokes. So it's an amazing world that's taking place. And it is, I think, the lure of the couch potato getting to meet Marilyn Monroe, but it is also clearly an educational tool that is oncoming.
I'm speaking with John Sacret Young. He's the executive producer of the new Fox TV series VR5. He also created and wrote the hit series China Beach and wrote the screenplays for the feature films Testament and Romero. Let's take a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with writer and producer John Sacret Young. You created the hit series China Beach. It's about a rest and recreation station in Da Nang, Vietnam. And that series also featured women as the lead characters. Is it your preference or just a coincidence that a lot of your TV work focuses on a woman's point of view?
Well, when I started writing, I'd spent a lot of time as a kid, you know, in locker rooms. I played sports, and I think I kind of suffered at some point from locker room overload of hanging around, you know, with too many sweat socks. And it was in the 80s a very interesting dilemma to think about all the issues that face women starting in the 60s, and how do you keep the plates in the air of having a personal life, having a business life, having a career, making money, dealing with children. The women's movement seemed to gain so many things, but it also how much did it gain, how much were losses, what were the compromises that had to be made. And that was, I thought, very fertile territory for drama and for storytelling and for the creation of characters.
You once said something interesting about writing for the actress Dana Delaney, who played the lead role in China Beach. You said that she moves in silence. When you write for her, you cut out words. What did you mean by that, and how do you cut out words?
Well, early on in that show, Dana and I had almost like an argument where she kept saying to me, you keep saying you want less. You know, pretty soon I'll be doing nothing. And I said, exactly. And she came up to me at some point and said, I get it, I get it. You want me to play Clint Eastwood? And I said, well, maybe not Clint Eastwood, but maybe Henry Fonda. And one of the things about that show was, in an odd way, it was almost a Western, where this strange group of people had gathered together on an outpost or a fort or whatever, except, of course, it wasn't a Western, it was an Eastern, because it took place in Vietnam. And she being the center of the show, the mast of the boat, the kind of crucial element in the ensemble, silence fit that character and fit what she can do so extraordinarily as an actress, which is she doesn't have to speak, that we as an audience can read the emotion she's carrying and we draw closer to her. And it isn't through words, it is through her face and through her actions. And part of the immense power, I think, in movies, whether you're dealing with, you could probably go back as far as Lillian Gish, or you certainly could go through the entire, let's say, John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, whatever, is not about action movies, it's about reaction, that we watch the faces, and those faces, in the emotions in those faces, we draw close.
You didn't serve in Vietnam, but your co-producer, William Broyles, did. How did your collaboration work? Did he supply stories and characters from his own experience and you refine them?
Well, I think we met at a very, I think it was a matter of synchronicity that we met. I had written about Vietnam before. I wrote, I think it's the only miniseries done to date about Vietnam, called A Rumor of War, based on Philip Caputo's book about his time there. And Bill had seen that, and he actually at first had the idea of doing a half-hour comedy, kind of set in Saigon, where a number of women entertainers come. And we started talking, and I, from my point of view and from my interest, said, God, wouldn't it be interesting to do a drama where you would shoot it on film and not on a sound stage, and you could get that real, you know, that more gritty feeling. And I think he was very taken by that idea, and his experiences were obviously crucial to the show. But even more, I think it was our goal from the beginning was to involve veterans, to hear their stories and to have them a part of the process. So that on the pilot alone, I would say we talked to at least 40 vets. And then each year before the show began shooting, we would have a weekend where we would invite vets to come and talk to us and spend time with us, with the actors, with the writers. And probably the most famous and maybe the episode that had the most accolades was an episode we did called Vets, where we interviewed on tape mostly women veterans. And we took those interviews and intercut them with footage from the show. And when we did it, ABC, the show was on ABC, was kind of went into massive alarm that people would be confused or people would turn off because, again, we were kind of connecting reality to fiction. And in fact, what happened was just the opposite. We got the most mail, the most response, the ratings weren't affected, and the show went on to win the Peabody Award, among others.
I read somewhere when you first came to L.A., you tried to get a job on the police force?
It is true. It was the time of Vietnam, and I thought a little bit, you know, America is so messed up, and where are we going to go? And there was choices. Should I stay here and where there were riots going on in the urban areas, or should I go to Southeast Asia? What should I do? And my choice was, however foolish or wrong-headed, was to say, well, let me stay here. And it was somewhat with the purpose in mind of, you know, I want to be a writer. Where is there going to be material? And it seemed to me that in the late 1960s, America was in such a turbulent place that there was plentiful, rich, interesting material. And my thought was, well, I'll become a cop, because they've got to be in this dilemma about, you know, how do I enforce things on the street when, in fact, we seem to be so mixed up, and how would that tear me apart as a policeman? You know, I'm not sure that was the sanest thing to do. And I think the LAPD, where I applied, looked at me and thought, this guy comes from the Ivy League. He's got long hair. He's got a mustache. Before it was de rigueur for LAPD cops to have a mustache. I don't know about this guy. He's pretty suspect. So I think we eventually kind of gazed at each other with equal suspicion.
Well, you didn't get the job. In fact, you flunked the eye test. What kept you in L.A.?
Well, for one thing, I come from the East Coast, and part of my journey was, as it is with many people, is let me get out of town, let me get as far away from where I grew up as possible so that I can grow up and have a chance and, I suppose, get away. And L.A. was pretty far away, as far as I could go in the continental United States. And it was so different that at first it was, you know, at one level I hated it. At another level, hate kind of almost burnishes material from you. It makes you alive. It makes you observe. It gets the emotions going. So in a way, as I hated it, I kind of fell in love with it. And it drew me because it was so different.
You wrote a novel about former stuntmen, The Weather Tomorrow, and these guys drink a lot. They did drugs. They carouse. They also worked in the movie industry, and it made me think that the movie industry can give a writer a lot of raw material to work with.
Well, I don't know. I've never been, I think, that excited about novels, about literally the movie industry, but the fringes of it have produced a kind of extraordinary body of work, and they're never big novels. They're small, kind of eccentric, but very intense ones. The Day of the Locust, Play as It Lays. I mean, there's a number of them, and that was kind of where I came from. It wasn't about wildly successful Hollywood producers or directors. It wasn't about stars. It was about that other world of, you know, which is 90% of it. Those on the fringes, those who could make it but don't, those who are still hanging out for that call from the agent or that, you know, that golden dream that might take place but seldom does.
Well, you have a novel coming out next year. Is it a relief for you to sit down and write your own novel all by yourself after working in the TV industry, which seems to be more of a chaotic group effort?
Writing a novel is the greatest pleasure and the biggest nightmare that I can imagine. When it's going well, there's nothing better. But the percentage of the time that it's going well is if you're lucky, maybe 5 or 10%. And so the rest of the days and nights are like anarchy. And the story that I'm trying to tell, which is about one American family, really from the close of World War II through the late 1980s, and again, it touches upon Vietnam, which is kind of the black, dark nexus of that time, as you take this family to the kind of hurricane of the 60s and 70s, I discover I'm now dealing, of course, though I went 3,000 miles away to escape my family, of course, I'm closing the circle now and dealing with many of the things that I saw and felt as I grew up.
John Sacred Young, I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you very much for coming on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
John Sacred Young is the creator and executive producer of VR5, a new TV series on Fox. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, two-for-ones, discount coupons, employee bonuses, and a dress code. Not a typical drug operation. Journalist William Adler tells the story of the Chambers brothers, who ran one of Detroit's most successful enterprises in the 1980s. Using well-proven business tactics, they built an empire on the sale of crack cocaine. It's the subject of Adler's book, Land of Opportunity. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Relish, the debut album by singer-songwriter Joan Osborne. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has accused Republicans today of planning to cut taxes for the wealthy by slashing services to the elderly. The president spoke to a group of seniors at the White House Conference on Aging today. He says reforming Medicare and Medicaid is a good idea, but he says slashing the programs without thinking it over carefully isn't the best way to go.
I will be there with you and for you to protect the legitimate interests of the senior citizens of this country and not to see us trade the long-term welfare and health of the American people for anybody's short-term gain. But you should also know that we need you to be here for us. We need for you to say, these are changes that make sense, these are changes that don't. These are things that will make us all stronger. These are things that will help you guarantee higher incomes and better wages and better future for our children and our grandchildren. These are things that will bring us together.
Mr. Clinton has also announced a federal-state partnership with Texas, Florida, Illinois, California, and New York that will crack down on Medicare fraud. The Senate has narrowly approved a plan to limit punitive damage awards in all civil lawsuits in federal and state courts. The amendment, sponsored by Majority Leader Bob Dole, follows a Senate vote yesterday to limit punitive damage awards in medical malpractice suits. Dole's amendment would cap punitive damages at twice a plaintiff's compensatory damages in all suits, not just those involving faulty products. Thousands of people marched through Paris today denouncing racism and fascism. The rally was held to protest the death of a Moroccan man who was pushed into the Seine River by three skinheads and he was drowned. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Throngs of people gathered near the Seine where the man drowned and then marched to the opera, chanting slogans against the extreme right. The Moroccan man was pushed into the river by three skinheads who broke away from a march held on Monday by extreme right-wing leader Jean-Marie Le Pen. Le Pen says his movement is not responsible. However, top political leaders on the left and the right say his hateful rhetoric against immigrants encourages this sort of violence against foreigners. Le Pen has called for the government to deport the 3 million immigrants in France, blaming them for unemployment, which is more than 12%. Police arrested 29 skinheads today and are questioning them. It's not known if they'll be charged. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
President Clinton's chief of staff says the people who bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City will be caught. Leon Panetta told CBS today the FBI is checking out thousands of leads. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 44 points today to close at a record high of 4373.15. This is NPR. A survey of American youngsters finds most aren't paying attention to nutrition and fitness. A new Gallup survey of more than 400 9 through 15-year-olds finds most understand the importance of eating right. But a third of them say they skip breakfast regularly. Another one-fifth say they miss dinner sometimes. More than 7 out of 10 say they know their favorite foods aren't good for them. A spokeswoman with the American Dietetic Association says the findings are startling. Japanese police have arrested the top lawyer for the religious sect Aum Shinrikyo. The group is suspected in the nerve gassing of the Tokyo subway system in March. The BBC's Katty Kay reports.
Yoshinobu Aoyama has been charged with defaming a fertilizer business based near the sect's headquarters after accusing the company of gassing the religious group. His arrest is the latest in a series of arrests of prominent Aum members. Mr. Aoyama's become a household name in Japan. He's appeared on Japanese television almost every day since the gas attack, protesting the sect's innocence. Since the attack, Mr. Aoyama has consistently claimed that police raids on own properties are unconstitutional. He's also made a point of reminding the Japanese media that none of the more than 100 OHM members who've been arrested during this investigation have actually been charged directly with the attack.
The BBC's Caddy Kay reporting from Tokyo. The State Department says one of the Americans imprisoned in Iraq has been found to have possible heart tissue scarring. A spokesman says William Barloon, who's serving an 8-year jail term for illegally entering Iraq, was hospitalized yesterday after complaining of chest pains. An Iraqi statement says nothing is the matter with Barloon, but it's his second trip to the hospital since he was imprisoned. The spokesman says Barloon's American colleague, David Daliberte, was also hospitalized yesterday, but it's unclear why. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The Chambers brothers were perhaps the most successful young entrepreneurs in Detroit during the 80s, but they didn't sell cars. Their product was crack cocaine. At the height of their empire, they ran 200 crack houses, employed 500 people, used business techniques worthy of a Fortune 500 corporation, and grossed up to $3 million a day. William Adler has written a book about the rise and fall of the Chambers Brothers' crack retailing operation. It's called Land of Opportunity. It tells the story of four brothers, Larry, Billy Joe, Otis, and Willie Chambers, who grew up in Marianna, Arkansas. Marianna is a town of about 6,000 people in the Arkansas Delta. Cotton was once the booming industry in Marianna, but by the 70s, cotton was long gone, and so were most jobs.
The Chambers' parents had been sharecroppers, and they had raised 14 children, and they had picked and chopped cotton. Most of them didn't have much of an education at all in school. Billy never graduated from high school, and the other ones barely attended school at all because they were needed in the fields nearly year-round. And so the place was still largely a segregated culture as well, and there was just very little that Marianna could offer anybody who didn't already have any money to begin with. And one of Billy's older brothers had dreamed of being a mailman. And he had taken the civil service test in Arkansas and then was told by a postmaster, forget it, there aren't any jobs for blacks in these counties. You're going to have to leave if that's what you want to do. And he was being truthful with Billy's older brother. So the young man left and he went to Detroit and he got a job as a letter carrier there. And that was the first Chambers brother to leave home for Detroit.
How did the brothers first get into drugs?
Well, when Billy Joe went to Detroit in 1978, he enrolled in high school. He had really determined that he wanted to graduate, and in fact, he had not learned to read back home in Arkansas, and that's one of the things he wanted to do too. And in the course of being in high school, he encountered an old friend from Arkansas who at that point, an older man, was selling marijuana on the streets of Detroit. And he used to give Billy and another friend of Billy's, with whom he had moved to Detroit, the scraps from basically the excess from the drugs that he had been selling. And Billy and his friend used to peddle loose joints in the hallways of their high school in Detroit. And from there, that proved to be so successful that they went into selling ounces of marijuana, and from there, pounds. And from there, another older brother actually had started a convenience store or a party store in Detroit, as they call it, where you would sell chips and soda, and they had video games. And Billy decided he would sell marijuana out of a back room of the convenience store. And that proved to be so successful that by 1983 or so, he bought a house for $500 or $1,000 on the east side of Detroit and started selling marijuana out of there. And then gradually got into crack cocaine. Actually, it wasn't gradually. In early 1984, a friend of Billy Joe's came to him and said, I need $10,000. And Billy said, what for? And his friend said, if you give me $10,000, I'll have that back for you and more in the course of the weekend. Billy said, what are you talking about? And the friend said, it's crack cocaine, man. If you think you're rich now, you're really going to be rich when you try crack cocaine. So Billy was doubtful, but he went ahead and he had worked with this guy before and he loaned him the money. And sure enough, there were lines around the block at this one house. That's how he started, and the business just took off exponentially from there.
It's interesting that they, the brothers, as you describe them, had a variety of businesses going on. They had this the convenience store. Billy Joe started with marijuana. Drugs just seemed to be a kind of diversification that got very lucrative. They didn't set out to be drug lords.
No, no, not at all. I mean, if Billy actually, when he was enrolled in high school, got a part-time job at a shoe store in Detroit, after-school job. He was a janitor there. And on occasion, they would have him outside in a blizzard washing the windows of the shoe store. And one day he finally said to himself, there's got to be a better way than this. And he, you know, eventually found what for him was a better way. But no, they did not set out to be drug dealers at first. But in Detroit also, I mean, as bad as the economy was in Arkansas at the time, in Detroit it was at least as bad, if not worse. I mean, when he got there in the late 1970s, in 78, the state, the city of Detroit was in ruin. I mean, the auto factories had moved out. There was barely nothing. There was no industry in town. Something like 34% of Detroit residents were on public assistance. That's 410,000 people, which were more residents than in Michigan's second and third largest cities. So, I mean, the place was truly, truly in ruin. And that was the economy that was thriving. The only economy that was thriving was the underground economy.
William M. Adler is my guest. He's a freelance writer. He's written a book called Land of Opportunity. It's about four brothers who established a drug empire in Detroit in the 80s. Their product was crack cocaine. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer William M. Adler is my guest. Once Billy Joe Chambers discovered how lucrative the crack dealing could be, he focused his energies on it. And you describe some time-honored sales tactics that he and his brother employed to establish what eventually became an empire that netted at $1.55 million a year for the brothers. Tell us about some of those tactics.
Okay. Well, I mean, the point that I was trying to make in the book is that there were a lot of parallels between the Chambers brothers and other successful entrepreneurs. I mean, you can carry them only so far because they were peddling an illegal product. But basically, what they had to do was they identified a niche in the marketplace. I mean, they had to assess the barriers to entry. They had to learn how to buy wholesale, to mass produce and market their product, to track inventory. I mean, all the sorts of things you might learn in business school, they learned on their own, on the street. I mean, they studied the interrelationship of investment and operations and financing, and they taught themselves how to analyze risk and monitor cash flow. They implemented strict quality control measures. I mean, that was one of the keys to their success, was their reputation for having high-quality crack. It was as important to them as Frank Perdue's image for tender chickens. I mean, it just, people would seek out the Chambers brothers because they had a pure product, and they didn't dilute it with any substance at all. It was pure crack cocaine.
Apparently, they also offered twofer sales and free samples and sales and half price days. It sounds as if they read some manual for young entrepreneurs.
They really were terrific marketers. They did offer all those things. Anything they could do to gain customer confidence and win brand loyalty, they would do.
You also describe one of the brothers' crack operations, one of the crack houses, as one-stop shopping behind closed doors. It sounds like a kind of Trump palace of crack houses. What was it like?
Well, that was an amazing place. Larry Chambers, who was considerably older than Billy, about 14 years older than Billy, he commandeered an apartment building on the east side of Detroit called the Broadmoor. The Broadmoor was decades past its prime, but it still had some tenants. It was about a 50-unit building, and all but four or five tenants. There only remained four or five tenants at the point Larry took it over. So Larry took over the Broadmoor, and he evicted the remaining tenants and basically set himself up an empire in there. And the way he did it was he hired doormen, Uzi-toting doormen, basically. And if a customer came to the front door, you would be asked, what do you want, a $5 rock, a $10 rock, or a $20 boulder? And he had the $5 apartment buildings on the apartments on the first floor, the $10 on the second floor, and the $20 boulders on the third floor. And you would be escorted there. And then salesmen behind locked gates would stick their arms out and show you a silvery saucer, basically, with the pebbles, the rocks. And you could pick one out, and then you pay your money. And then you would be escorted either outside the apartment building or to one of the units that they used as what they called a smokehouse to smoke it.
The organization also had guiding principles, which were written up on a poster in one of the crack houses and found in a police raid. They were do's and don'ts, complete with lists of violations and dollar fines for the violations. What were some of the guiding principles?
Well, that's right. They had a wrecking crew, which was to enforce Larry's principles. And some of them were stealing among the group was a $300 fine. Fighting among the group was a $100 fine. If you brought strangers to the house, you would be fined $500. And he also told his employees that you shouldn't wear chains or Fila gym shoes, those status gym shoes at the time, or don't wear gold. In other words, don't be flamboyant. Don't call attention to yourself. He said you should forget about your girlfriends if you want to get rich. And he said your success is going to depend on how well you follow his instructions. And people believed him, and they did. And many of them were successful financially.
Billy Joe Chambers and his brother Larry didn't smoke crack, and they seemed to know it was really bad news. Do you think that was part of the key to their success, their self-discipline?
Absolutely. I mean, not only didn't they not smoke crack, they didn't drink coffee, they didn't drink soda, they were vegetarians, they wanted absolutely no toxins in their own systems. And they insisted that their employees not smoke crack. They didn't actually resort to drug testing, but they may as well have, and they could very well tell who was on crack, and they fired many people who they suspected either of stealing the product or of smoking it, or both.
Well, the empire finally crumbled in the way that many empires do. Associates turned against the brothers. People felt they weren't getting their fair share. It seemed to get a little too big for too big an organization for them to handle. Once they were indicted and on trial, did the brothers stick together or did they turn against each other?
No, everybody pretty much stood together, stuck together, with the exception of one of their associates who had grown up in Arkansas as well and who did testify against them. He later recanted his testimony after trial, but his testimony and that of a woman named Patricia Middleton, who interestingly was the only white person who was a central figure in this case. She had worked as a courier for them, and she also worked at a Big Boy restaurant in Detroit, and she used to wear her Big Boy uniform while she was driving around for the Chambers brothers at night. And so she drove an old AMC Gremlin, a 1976 Gremlin. So she was innocuous. Nobody ever thought to stop her or thought that she would be, you know, fit any sort of drug dealing profile. But in fact, she carried a lot of money for them, and she ended up testifying against them as well. But for the most part, the brothers entirely stuck together.
You write that these men and successful other successful big-time drug dealers are embracing mainstream values, values of enterprise, of hard work, of sacrifice, of financial success, the American dream, and that these enterprising young men had few, if any, legal opportunities to exercise their talents. And the implication is that our society is creating its most antisocial element, that the drug culture is our culture. It's a mirror. If this is a fair reading of your analysis, does that exonerate in any way, in your eyes, these men and women who deal drugs?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. I think the drug dealers have to be punished. There have to be consequences for illegal actions. And, you know, though you can blame society for not giving them better educational opportunities down home in Arkansas, or better job opportunities, nevertheless, they made the decision to get into the business they got into, and you know, there has to be a price paid for that. And so I don't think they should be exonerated in any way at all, no.
What does Billy Joe Chambers think of his life story now that he's had some time to think about it?
Well, I think he's obviously regretful that he's going to be spending, that he'll be in prison until 2015. Anybody would be, but I think as he looks back, he might do it again if he didn't think he was going to be caught. He just didn't see any other way to live his life at that time in his life. And he's getting older now. He's all of 32, but he has had a lot of time to reflect. And I think one of the things he would do differently is probably have stayed around Arkansas longer than he had, rather than run away at the age of 16 when he was so impressionable.
I want to thank you very much for talking with me on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
William Adler is the author of Land of Opportunity. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel joins us to talk about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hiya, Barbara. We're going to be hearing today about the second day of confirmation hearings of Dr. Henry Foster. He's President Clinton's nominee to be Surgeon General. Also, Tom Gelton has more on the shift in U.S. policy toward Cuba. We'll be hearing about how automatic teller machine cards, ATM cards, might help law enforcement officers track down those who use them. And we'll also be hearing about the shelling of the Croatian capital, Zagreb. And on today's program, Wendy Schmelzer reports on the growing number of centenarians, people over 100 years of age, in America.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered on National Public Radio. Joan Osborne's debut album, Relish, has been praised for its raw passion and honest emotionalism. Rock critic Ken Tucker also likes Osborne's debut, but for different reasons.
Let me use your toothbrush. Have you got a clean shirt? My panties in a wad at the bottom of my purse. I walk into the street.
I'd read quite a bit about Joan Osborne before I actually heard her music. Before I'd slipped her disc onto my CD player, I knew Osborne was a singer-songwriter who'd attracted a sizable following in Greenwich Village for her big-throated singing. She was compared to Bonnie Raitt for her forthright approach to a white woman singing the blues. The quickly defined party line on Osborne is that here we have a new voice of authenticity, singing from her heart with her guts. But when I actually sat down and listened to Relish, what attracted me most about it was that it was so gloriously phony.
Where are the bones on that one? What if the cure is worse than the disease? Stir me up, some pretty, pretty people. Stir me up, somebody.
Relish was produced by Rick Chertoff, who once helped nurse the pop ironies of Cyndi Lauper to fruition. Chertoff also produced The Hooters, a next big thing from Philadelphia that never quite became the next big thing. And two Hooters, Rob Hyman and Eric Bazillion, have collaborated with Joan Osborne in writing and playing many of the songs here. If there's one thing Chertoff, Hyman, and Bazillion have in common, it's slickness. These guys know every rock cliché in the book, and their creativity lies in recombining those clichés. In Joan Osborne, they found an ideal vessel for their notions of nouveau blues rock.
You gotta tell me, baby, I can't do it all by myself. You gotta help me, baby, I can't do it all by myself. You don't help me, daddy, gotta find somebody else.
That's Osborne offering her version of Sonny Boy Williamson's Help Me, and it reminds me of the past 30 years of white singers who have, with great earnestness and conviction, recorded watery, glossy music, from John Mayall and Janis Joplin to Ricky Lee Jones and Tom Waits. Here's Osborne pursuing Ray Charles on a song she co-wrote.
Dreamed about Ray Charles last night, and he could see just fine, you know.
I like Osborne's stiff phrasing. It's her way of communicating sincerity. I also like the way, for a Greenwich Village singer-songwriter, there's very little self-pity or confessional drivel in her work. She ain't no throwback to a more innocent time. She's a portent of the postmodernism that's already here.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Joan Osborne's debut album, Relish. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Barbara Bogave.
And your hands are really shaking something awful.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.